Welcome back to Bright Brains. We are going to delve into a pressing social matter in today's episode. I have the privilege of talking to Michael Fryer, an esteemed attorney deeply invested in understanding and addressing the complex phenomenon of homelessness. Join us as we explore the factors contributing to the escalating crisis of homelessness and seek solutions to pave a path forward towards meaningful change. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thank you very much, Isaac. It's good to be here.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved with this issue.
Sure. I was an elementary school teacher for about 10 years and transitioned from the classroom into child protection and mental health. I was actually an employee as a social worker for Child Protection Services in Connecticut, just the Department of Children and Families. And while I was there, I was completing a law degree. When I graduated, my first practice was actually focused on juvenile law. So I did juvenile public defense, and I represented kids and families that were involved in child protection. A large number of the issues that you deal with in child protection are trauma histories, mental health, and addiction. So in that circumstances, particularly when you're working with teens, you will find there's a large homeless population, runaway and homeless population. So that's how I got introduced to homelessness, mental health issues, addiction issues, trauma care. Was just first as a social worker with CPS and then as an attorney dealing in that area. Their program got shut down. The state contract was eliminated. Positions were all dispersed. They were absorbed into the public defender's office. So having this now experience, I went to work for probate court. I got a contract with the state to work as a conservator. So I am responsible for the financial care and health care of those that identified as unable to care for themselves. So currently I have about 50 clients. I make sure the bills are paid, make sure the rent's paid, coordinate health care, whatever it might be. As a result of doing that work for some time, I was also involved in mental health advocacy, mental health law, homelessness, just a large number of things. And I'm actually down in the DC area. I do volunteer pro bono work here. And then I actually have a contract in Ramsey County, which is St. Paul, Minnesota, working with a team of folks there in order to address problems and concerns with regard to justice involved homeless. They have what's called a Rule 20. I can talk a little bit about. But we're trying to create a system by which we get people housed who are currently either sitting in corrections. They're ready for discharge. They can leave jail or prison, but there's just no appropriate housing for them. Or they're sitting in the hospital identified as able to discharge, but there's just no housing. So they're sitting at the hospital just waiting. So that's the team is addressing, identifying and finding housing for those folks.
Let's hop into it, man. So why is homelessness seem to be booming out of control? What's your take on that?
So I it's a complex situation, but at the end of the day, the simplest way to explain it is at the end of the 70s, there was a hospitalization system where you had state hospitals that would identify and care for folks that were deemed unable to care for themselves. And that hospital system was abused. There were horrors that were done and were problems. So instead of doing a reform on the hospitals, they decided to say, look, we're going to close all the hospitals and resort to essentially community services. You'll get community care, community support, community housing, whatever it is. What they didn't do when they closed the hospitals is create those community settings. They just kind of said, hypothetically, you can return to, you know, whatever city or whatever town, and there will be a service there that didn't exist that will address your needs or concerns. And again, these are folks that they're what's called dual diagnosed. So they have a severe and pervasive mental health disorder, most typically schizoaffective disorder, and they have addictions. The addictions usually come about for self-medication in order to deal with schizoaffective disorder, but they have the two. So, you know, it's already a very, very difficult life that you're living, dealing with a profound mental health issue as well as addiction, and then return to the community with no resources that are able to help you. So the resources were built up through the 80s and the 90s, but what ended up happening is there was a flip, and it's a fascinating flip that I find with regard to mental health care. And to to give you an idea of how bad it is, a lot of people don't understand. Hey, there's a guy on the street corner, typically. He's buck naked. He is clucking like a chicken, and he's running around in traffic. Why can't someone come down and take him to the hospital? The police came down and talked to him, and they shrugged and they left. Because the only way you are hospitalized in the United States, brought to a hospital, is you have to be a threat to yourself, so suicidal, or engage in a behavior that would clearly put your life at risk, or you have to be a threat to others, homicidal. So you have to be trying or actively attempting to kill or harm another person. Those are the only two circumstances you're hospitalized. So if you are not engaged in a behavior that could be injurious to yourself or injurious to another, they will just let you go. There is literally nothing that can be done. On the mental health side, I'll give you a real quick example. So I had a client who was in a group home, attempted to kill someone else in the group home, went after him, was beating on him. They were convinced he wouldn't stop. They were able to physically intervene and call the police, got him arrested, got him to the hospital. While in the hospital, he said, "No, I'm fine. I'm calm. I'm not going to do anything to him." He called his mom and said, "The minute I get back there, I'm going to kill him." He called me as his conservative. "The minute I get back there, I'm going to kill him." He let everyone know that the minute he left the hospital, he was going to kill that kid. Like he was going right after him. But in the hospital, when asked, he said, "No." So I called the hospital, talked to the psychiatrist, and I'm like, "Look, he's making phone calls. He's on the phone. He's telling everyone what he's going to do." And the psychiatrist said, "That's fine. That's not because of his mental health. If he is unable to understand that it is wrong to do and will lie to me and tell me he's not going to do it, then yes, he's going to commit a crime, but that crime is not due to his mental health." So I've had some very fascinating interactions with psychiatrists over where do you draw the line between what is self-injurious behavior. I had a client who had HIV, refusing to take his medications. Does take his medications, including a steroid, he could die. So he didn't take his medications could lead to his death. But from a psychiatric point of view, he has the ability to choose not to. So the change and the shift that existed in mental health care was to what's called client-centered. So rather than identifying, hey, this person has a mental health issue that's going to result in their homelessness, this person has a mental health issue that's going to result to them, being buck naked on the street, clucking like a chicken and running up and down, whatever it might be. Therefore, we need to help them because the system is not set up for those individuals. Where we ended up is we're going to assist, we're going to treat them as if they are rational. So as rational as you and I are having this conversation, someone who is literally in a state of psychosis, as long as they're not threat of self, threat or other, we're going to treat them as if they are equally as rational. And the decisions that they are making are equally as rational, which is how you end up with, for instance, with needle exchanges. So you have, folks that are addicts in a compassionate society. We would like to help people whose addictions are out of their control, who has resulted in homelessness. I don't want to get into the, tons of people take drugs, tons of people use coke, tons of people smoke pot. They lead productive lives. They're fine. Not addressing, whether or not, drugs should or should not be in society. Not there. Where I am is you have an addiction to the point where it is so debilitating that you are literally sitting on a street corner, zombied out, homeless. We're not going to help them because we are client focused. We'll get them needles to do their drugs. We will, get them whatever they need. We will defend their right, as happens in San Francisco, to sit on that street corner, use drugs, and die of dehydration or die of starvation. Because it's self-determinative. So we got there, but we got there not necessarily because we're not a compassionate society. We got there because the system is so broken that there is no resource to help that person, and there is no vested interest in the mental health industry to help them. So because, and I can talk a little bit about that as well. So because we're at a position where mental health is not going to address essentially mental health issues, they have taken on an attitude of, well, it's really up to the person, and there's nothing we can do unless they want to participate. So that's why we've seen this kind of explosion of homelessness, particularly among dual diagnosed addicts, we'll do it like mental health and addiction, is because the system itself has no longer a compassionate system and is no longer a system that is interested in helping them. It is a system that has become generating insane revenue for the mental health side of it, and with no obligation whatsoever to intervene or assist the clients who they're supposed to be helping.
How are they generating revenue, and who's making money off of these people?
So the most cynical situation, which does ex this does exist, this does happen, but it's not the typical situation. I want to make it very clear, when I'm going to start talking about examples. There are some of those amazing people I've ever met are involved in this space, 100% committed, 100% concerned, and equally as frustrated. On the ground, social workers are probably it's the they have the highest turnover, the highest burnout, because they're put in positions where they want to desperately help their clients. They're emotionally invested in helping their clients, but they can't because of the restrictions that essentially are put on them. So they're compassionate people that are not allowed to be compassionate, essentially. And it so there's Matt. So I want to be very clear before I begin talking about this, that there are some amazing and wonder majority, amazing and wonderful people that are in the space for the right reasons and desperately, desperately want to help. But you'll also note again, the burnout is horrendous, a year, maybe two, that people will last in them. So here's the most cynical version. I'm a politician. I've got to generate constant, money. You're constantly campaigning as a politician. I need money. I need money. I need money to campaign. So I take a buddy of mine and I'm like, hey, you're in this space. I'm going to give you $1 billion. I want you to go out and set up a nonprofit, knock yourself out, pay yourself $500,000 as the CEO, hire some staff, get a purpose together, everything else. And then what you're going to do is you're going to have the staff and the agency is going to kick money back to, this PAC. So I'm going to give you $1 billion. You're going to 10 or 15 million is going to go back into this PAC fund. So it's an extreme example, but that does happen where a lot of these nonprofits get set up because they generate revenue back into campaigns and PACs. So then this company gets set up, and they offer services. So when you look at like a California where they dump $26 billion to the homeless effort, $26 billion does not go to the homeless. $26 billion goes to the nonprofits or other organizations that work with the homeless. But you get into these really wild situations. For instance, I'm always amazed that again, you do something for long enough, it becomes second nature, and then you things that you think are just, general knowledge are not. For instance, do you know the difference between a wet shelter and a dry shelter?
No, I've never heard of that before.
Okay. So a wet shelter is one where you can come in no matter what state you're in, drunk, high, whatever. You can come into the shelter and you can use or drink in the shelter. Now, a lot of them be like, hey, we don't want you. We don't want needles coming in. We don't want anything else. But they're a wet shelter. So you're allowed to be drunk. You're allowed to be high, whatever. Now, this goes without saying, those are the most violent places to be. None of my clients will go to a wet shelter ever because you've got people that are drunk and high and, on drugs and probably off their medications. They are not good places to be. But Connecticut, for instance, passed a law that said all shelters must be wet. So we had a shelter that was in Manchester, Connecticut, amazing place, 40 bed, food bank, kitchen, two hot meals a day, the whole nine yards, but it was a dry shelter. Now, a dry shelter means you cannot be on any substances and you cannot use any substances in the shelter. It is substance free. You cannot come in if you're drunk. You cannot come in if you're high. If they feel that you are drunk or high, they can refer you out for testing because it could just be, again, you're in some mental health state, you're off your medication and something is unbalanced and you appear to be drunk or high, but you're not actually. Usually they do a hospital referral at that point because it's like, hey, this could be an issue. They were all shut down. So they were told, you can become a wet shelter. And they said, no, because we have security issues, we have problems, we're able to offer the services we are because we can guarantee that the folks that are coming in off the street, remember, these are people that are very concerned about the folks who are suffering and on the street. These are compassionate folks. They recognize what's going on. We are not going to do this to the people coming in. We are safe, we are secure, and people trust us because we're a dry shelter. But the legislature came in and said, nope. Everywhere's got to be a wet shelter. So they closed this entire facility. Closed. 50 beds, gone. Food bank, gone. Two hot meals a day, gone. So you end up with, and these are the kinds of decisions that are made. So you end up with a wet shelter system that no one that the homeless don't want to use because they're violent And they have all kinds of security issues, and you can't trust what's going on. So, and again, the homeless themselves. So, for instance, you they'll set up shelter systems that no one utilizes because of these issues. They will set up, social work or case management services, where it's like, hey, we're going to identify you need to go to rehab, you need to, these things. We'll have you come in for individual or group therapy. We may or may not be able to provide transportation depending on the funding and budget they have, and we'll set up. And then the person will be like, no, thank you, and walk off. And they're like, and again, it's client-centered services, like, oh, well, to participate, there's nothing we can do. Well, meanwhile, that person's still drawing a 70, 80, $90,000 a year salary with benefits. They may have a caseload of 10 clients. But if all 10 clients are like, I don't want your services, I don't like you, what do they do for work? Again, I'm going to tell you what they do. The conscientious ones who are compassionate go out into the community and go find their clients, and they check in with them, and they make sure they're safe, and they try. But again, year two burnout, people that are lasting in, they just kind of get to the, what am I supposed to do? My management tells me I can't do anything for them if they don't want me to. The general approach in mental health is it's client based. So if they don't want help, there's nothing I can do. And a lot of the clients are, in the community, and kind of go into, why they're fine and why they're happy and why they're there. But through addicts using drugs, it's a little more complex than that. So you end up again, like in California, $28 billion. You have the bad end of the spectrum, which is, yeah, we're going to set this up. We're going to kick back money into a PAC or into campaign funds or whatever else. You have the other end of the spectrum, people that are very, very compassionate, and this is what they want to do, but they're hamstrung by your shelter's going to be wet, so no one wants to use it. They're hamstrung by, the approach is client-based, so there's nothing you can do if they don't want to participate.
So let me ask you this. Why did they convert them in Connecticut? Why did they convert all of their shelters to WET? What was the reasoning behind that?
There was a lobbying group that felt that people who should have access to drugs should have access to drugs, and people who drink, just because you drink doesn't mean you should have access to shelter. Again, it's kind of a compassionate approach from their end in that, hey, just be, someone's drunk and they're an alcoholic and they're on the street and need a shelter. You can't turn something like that away. Like, what are they supposed to do? They're drunk, they're intoxicated, they're not in their right mind, they still need a bed. So it's this, again, compassionate approach, but without, a common sense grounding of, taking an intoxicated person and putting them into an environment with other addicts, or taking someone who is high and putting them in an environment, what is then going to happen? They didn't go to stage two in their thinking. They were just sitting there saying, we don't feel it is appropriate for someone that just because, they, injected heroin, or they're on fentanyl, or they've been drinking, that they should then be trapped out on the street. They need shelter too. So compassion.
Yeah, so it's sometimes with a lot of these social issues, it feels like people are so compassionate that their brain just kind of shuts off. So my thinking is, why not just like have a few WET shelters, and then like maybe half and half, or like maybe 30% of these shelters are WET, and then like maybe 70% are dry. I don't understand why all of them. And when they were debating this, or when the lobby group was coming up with this idea, was there any kind of pushback against that?
There was an enormous amount of pushback, and not just from the shelter system itself. There was pushback from homeless advocacy groups. There was pushback from case management groups, a lot. But part of it also is, and this is what I find so bizarre, is a lot of groups don't understand. For instance, I'll have a conversation. We had a team meeting on one client. It was a brutal, brutal, brutal case. Really awful. And it was, I mean, multiple charges, some pretty severe charges. Was either in the hospital or was in jail, would come out, would do some pretty bad things. So I'm not, we had the two social workers from two different public defenders office. We had case management involved. We had the hospital, actually multiple hospitals, because what he would do, fascinating enough, and I have a bunch of clients that do this. It's not unusual, actually, because the solution to, hey, I can't find a shelter bed, which is part of the problem, very limited number of shelter beds anyways, I can't find a shelter bed, is he would do is he would get drunk. He would go to the parking lot of a hospital outside the emergency room. He would bomb alcohol very quickly, so his blood alcohol level was high, and he would walk in drunk and be like, "I'm intoxicated." And because his blood alcohol level was so high, they had to take him in as a patient. So he did that every night for 8.5 months. Now I know that because I'm his conservator and I have to give permission to treat. So every night, somewhere between 11 p.m. and 1 a.m., I would get a phone call from the hospital saying, "Hey, so and so is here. We need permission to treat." And I'm like, "Okay." And it got to the point where it was pretty bad. Like it was like every night. So now I'm personally motivated and desperate in order to get.
Hello, you there?
I got booted. Ooh. What was the
Yeah.
last thing that you? What was the last thing you heard me
All
say?
right. So basically, you were talking about the guy who was drinking alcohol outside of a hospital and to get admitted.
Right. So this is not unusual. A lot of them will do this. They'll get intoxicated. They'll do something in order to get medically admitted. He did it for 8.5 months and every night. And I know this because as a conservator, I have to give permission to treat. So every night for 8.5 months, between 11 p.m. and 1 a.m., I would get a phone call saying, "Hey, we need permission to treat." And so clearly, I'm personally motivated to get him housing. He was unhousable, and I can talk a little bit about what that means. Not him specifically, but just in general, why that does occur. So we're on this meeting, again, a couple social workers from public defender's office. We got a psychiatrist. We've got case manager from a couple of towns. We got all the social workers from all the area hospitals to have this brainstorm meeting in order to figure out how can we help this guy we're supposed to do. And I asked, because again, we had these barriers. How many of you, like 25 people, how many of you have talked to your state legislator? And they're like, "Who?" I'm like, you have a legislator, a representative at the state. How many of you have ever called to talk about, these issues?" They're like, "What do you mean?" So these are people with master's degrees, with PhDs or MDs that don't understand. So they don't follow when bills are introduced. They don't belong to advocacy groups. They don't follow along with changes in law, and they have no idea even who their state rep is. And that And so the several prominent political figures in the Senate and the House in Connecticut are friends with for several reasons. Again, Connecticut's a small state. You're around long enough, you meet people. And I was actually talking with the majority speaker for the legislature about this. And he's an attorney and he's kind of in the area, so we know each other. And he's like, "I have never in my career gotten a phone call from anyone in the mental health field." He's like, "I have no idea what's going on other than cases I do or clients I have. I have
Wow.
never had anyone in." So that's how that you end up with these massive changes because people aren't paying attention. Now, again, this is a very high demanding area of time, effort, and energy. So, you're working 8, 10 hour days, 5, 6 days a week, to then try to go and pay attention to what's going on politically is it's an extra ask. A lot of people don't have the energy, the bandwidth for it. So I understand, but that's how you end up in these situations with these groups that will go in and make these wild demands because they're the only ones speaking. So the legislators are all like, "Well, clearly this is an issue. They came forward. They're talking about this. It sounds right." And there's no one on the other side, or no one in opposition to it, and no one on the other side saying anything. So we're going to make the shelters all wet now.
Yeah, that's wild, man. So these lobby groups, I'm curious, like the people who are in these groups, like what is their background? Because I feel like lately there have been like a number of issues where I think people mean well, but they kind of come up with ideas that are far out of the box. Like here's a couple examples. One is defund the police. I think that there needs to be criminal justice reform, but to defund the police, that seems like too out there of a solution. I mean, crime still exists, so why would you do that? Another thing is like in Oregon, they made all of the drugs decriminalized, and I think they just recently had to revert back. So my question is, like these lobby groups, I think they mean well, but what is their background, and then how do we counter them? Like, do the people with common sense, do they have their own lobby groups? Like, what's going on there?
So I'll give you an example. I do a lecture on fallacious thinking. Fallacy, by the way. I say that
Gotcha.
sometimes, and people are like, "Do you mean?" No. I mean,
I was wondering
organ.
too. I
No.
got
So, the example that I use, that I love, it's this is a misuse of the example, but it's a good for understanding what goes on. So there was a Greek philosopher, Zeno, and he liked to do things on time and motion. That was like his thing. He liked to just sit and think about time and motion. And one of the questions he asked, he said, "Look, there's an infinite number, right? There's no final number in the universe. Every time you go to one, there's always one more." So he said, "It's interesting because the same thing is true about fractions and halves." So he asked the question that I find fascinating. He said, "If I'm sitting in a chair and I want to walk out the door across the room, I have to cover half the distance. Then I have to cover half that distance. Then I have to cover half that distance. And since there's an infinite number of halves, can I ever reach the door?" There are people that'll hear that and be like, "That is logically sound." Right? Because there are an infinite number of halves. And if you really buy into that idea, then you can't walk out a door. And of course, the practical application is I'm going to walk out, I'm going to get out of my chair, I'm going to walk right out the door. So it's this very interesting question that sounds perfectly logical. Perfectly logical. And if you buy into it, you will now sit in your chair the rest of your life because, well, logically, I can't leave the room. But we all know you can practice. So I think what ends up happening is there's a very large list of different types of thinking fallacies, of fallacious thinking. But what ends up happening, I think, is with these groups and other people is much like in that example, they have created a logical construct that sounds good, that to them makes sense. But when you get to practical reality, has no application at all. Eliminating dry shelters is a great example of that. Defunding the police, great example of that. You come up with this. Now it's also the defund the police involves a lot of inductive thinking, which is go find a bunch, come up with an idea and go find a bunch of facts that support your thinking, as opposed to deductive, which is look at all the facts and figure out what they're telling you. So there, that's a whole different issue. But I think that this is actually the fascinating thing. Again, being in this line of work and having work, there is an incredible amount of compassion and positive thinking that if we could harness it in an appropriate direction, the things that we could do as a society are amazing. And I think that we all recognize that as human beings. I truly believe as Americans, we are truly a compassionate society. But compassion that's not tempered by reality, compassion that's not tempered by fact, compassion that doesn't recognize, the harm that it causes. I don't want to hit another hot button issue, but gender care in children with the CAS report that just came out of England and a bunch of other stuff. Again, another area where I truly believe people were being compassionate, but with no grounding in reality. And now that the reality is coming out, we begin to see that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. There's a reason that saying exists. So yeah. So the example I give is the door one, is getting halfway to the door. Because we can all look at it and go, oh yeah, you know what? That logically does make sense. How do you get out the door? And in case you're wondering, that's actually why that question led to the invention of calculus, no joke. And calculus has a formula that explains how you can get out the door. There's an answer to that question. But we had to invent calculus in order to answer the question that he asked. But again, the whole point of the example is that you can have something that sounds so logically sound and sounds so reasonable, but is yet so devoid of any factual basis and is clearly disrupted by reality. So that's what we have in the space when you start looking at these different places. I immediately think of Zeno's example on motion. It's like, yep, this is a group of people that have convinced themselves of something logically that has no basis and are proceeding full speed forward on it. That if they just took a moment to look at what the reality of the situation, what the impact of these decisions are, they would realize that it makes it worse. And that's how you end up with San Francisco.
All right. So you mentioned about social workers having restrictions
Yes.
that prevent them. So what kind of restrictions do they have?
So this is an example, and it's kind of funny because everyone gets this is how I can tell what kind of social worker is immediately. And as soon as I say this example, anyone listening to this is either going to agree 100% and think that this idea is the most wonderful idea ever, or they're going to immediately going to hate me and think I should be fired and never allowed to work with homeless again. It is this example is that divisive.
All right.
So this is what I do. And I'm allowed to do this, but I want to make this very clear. I'm not violating any rules, I'm not breaking any laws. I am 100% allowed to do this. And as an attorney, I've made sure I'm allowed to do this because I don't want to lose my job and I want to be able to keep working with people. So 90% of dual diagnosed folks receive Social Security disability. By the way, for those not familiar, the Social Security disability currently pays monthly $940. So if I have a client who's on Social Security disability, who's never worked, has no quarters in, on $940, I have to house, clothe, and feed them in a month, including paying utilities and phone. So I want you to think about that for a second. The next time someone complains, wow, I'm making 4 grand a month and I can't make ends meet. I do it for my clients on 940. It is not a great life. It is not a comfortable life, but they do have a roof over their head. They have food. They do get food stamps. They get other we try for supplements or other things to help them out. But Social Security disability base rate right now is 940. That's it. That's all they get. So I set up a budget. My requirement with my clients, even if it's $20 a month, you got to save something. You got to have some kind of fund because you're going to need a winter coat. You're going to need boots. You're going to be something else. A lot of donation centers are gone. They do have, places you can go for secondhand stores, Salvation Army, and other things. But a lot of the, hey, you can get this stuff for free, that's all gone. That doesn't exist anymore. Walmart used to do vouchers, doesn't do vouchers. Part of the problem is that Walmart used to do tens of thousands of dollars in vouchers, where they would give you a voucher. $1,500, and then you would go to the store and be able to buy $1,500 worth of stuff. Walmart would then take the voucher that was brought in and send it up to the state and say, reimburse us. And again, it's $100,000 in trillion-dollar budget. And the state would take 6 months, a year, 2 years to reimburse for the vouchers. So Walmart told the state to go pound sand. We're not going to do it anymore because you're not paying us. So a lot of these things that did exist don't necessarily exist anymore, which is really too bad because we get vouchers or gift cards or other stuff that we were able to use that again we're supposed to be reimbursed. The state dropped the ball on that one. So they have to save something because they need to save, even if it's $20 a month. We then figure out what their bills are going to be, rent. We try to get people into places that utilities are included, hot water's included, heat's included. So it's just a flat fee for the rent. We're not dealing with other bills. Although there's reason to have at least an electric bill or something just because you got a utility bill in your name. That way, if you need a photo ID, if you need anything else, you've got a utility bill coming to you. Phone, there are free phones. People do like to get their phones. There are phones, cell phone plans out there. They're 15, 30, $40 a month. So they're affordable. And then what I do is I get them an ATM card. So a lot of conservators issue checks, which are problems if you don't have a photo ID, if you don't have somewhere to go to the cash. And quite frankly, a lot of folks that are dual diagnosed coming off the street, they're not the cleanest, they don't smell the nice, they don't have the best clothes. They go walking into a bank with a check, and it's immediately suspicious. Why is this person coming in? So
Gotcha.
I get them an ATM card just because there's some dignity to it. And if someone calls me and says, "Hey, I need $100 because I got to go buy something," I'm like, "No problem. Call me, log into the bank, put the money in the account." Bam, they can go right out. It's instantaneous. But so what I do is I also give their money weekly. So every Monday, they get money transferred onto their card. That way, they're getting money 4 times a month. That way, they're never more than 6 days from the next cash. If I give them all to them, front load them in the beginning of the month, they spend it all in a week, and then the 3 weeks without money, I'm concerned they're not going to get food. They're not going to have access to things. So my system is $50 on a Monday on the ATM card. Call me if you need additional funds. That's what the savings is for. So that's how I set it up. But you only get the $50 on Monday if you're compliant with your services. So you have to go into the case management. You had to go, whatever it is, the minimal you're asked to do, and it's usually not much. You showed up for your injections, your medications. You've done whatever you need to do. The agency will call me and say, "Hey, on Friday they'll call me and say, hey, he showed up or she showed up. They're good to go." Monday, the money goes on the card. I only do this in the case of people who are at risk in the community, who have not been compliant with services, and have been identified to be at risk of hospitalization or institutionalized. So if someone's clicking along and doing their own thing, or case management service isn't worried about them, I don't even bother. It's an automatic transfer. The client and I talk about other things. We're not worried about it. So not every client do I do this for. It'd be a massive pain, quite frankly. I would be willing to do it, but it'd be a massive pain for 50 clients to be, you know, on the phone Friday talking about 50 people doing these things. So I get either the case managers love me because they're compassionate and their clients are showing up in the office and they're doing their individual or they're doing their med routines or they're doing whatever they need to be done, and they get to see them and they get to talk to them and they think I'm the biggest hero that has ever walked the planet. Or they think I'm the most evil person because they are self-determinative and the fact that I am denying them their money on a Monday because they did not participate in services, that I am a terrible human being and I should be fired. There is no middle ground on that. There is no gray area. Though it is polar extremes in the fact that I do that. Now, again, if Monday I get a call, because what will end up happening is a client will call me on Monday because the money's not on the card. Like, where's my money? And I'm like, well, you didn't do any of your services last week. What do? Go down to your case manager, say hello, wave at them, have the case manager call me and tell me you showed up, and I'll put the money on the card. Like, they still get the money on Monday. Just, they need to be seen by a human being that, yes, you're okay, that, you know, you look like you've eaten or you don't look like you've eaten, you're wearing clothes with, you know, shoes with holes in them, we got to get you shoes, whatever it be. You know, we want you to see a human being. So when you talk about the system and the state that it's in, this is one of the first indications that I had that, the system was broken at some level. When I'm a lawyer, you know, again, I don't have a mental health background in that, you know, I went to school for social work or you know, any of that. I was an elementary school teacher and then an attorney. But I looked at the situation and said, there's a very simple solution to this. And by the way, I use credit unions because credit union ATM cards can be used at various credit unions. So if I went to Bank of America, you can only use a Bank of America ATM fee-free. I use credit unions because you can go to credit union, any credit union about that's in that network, and you can use that one free. So, you know, it gives them far more options in order to be able to get money out without paying a fee. That's the other thing. So when I tell you this is very well thought out and it's really for the benefit of the client, I'm doing everything I can to help them, I ain't kidding. Even then, because it's not self-determinative, and I've had a social worker look at me and start yelling at me because it's their money, not my money. I have to give it to them. And that is actually not the case with Social Security. Social Security will terminate Social Security if you are in jail or in a hospital for 30 days. They end it. Social Security will limit the amount of Social Security you can get if you are recognized homeless and refusing to get a place to live. They'll cut it in half. So it's Social Security is for the benefit of the individual in order to make sure they are housed, clothed, and fed because they have recognized that they have a disability. Technically, they're unable to work. There's a whole line on that one. I'm not even going down that road. But again, it's only 940. So, and I do have clients that work, by the way, that do.
So you said they're not allowed to work if they're on.
So in order to get disability, you have to have a medical doctor saying you cannot work. That's the only way you can be on 100% disability. But again, it's $940 a month. There is a work program that Social Security does encourage. I do have clients that do work. If you sign up for the program and go in, you can work up to a certain point and keep your Social Security. After that point, where the income is, it's then a 2-for-1. For every $2 you make, you lose a dollar of Social Security. So at the end of the day, if you're getting 940, you're going to have to be pulling, you know, little north of $2,000 a month working in order to lose your Social Security. Well, when you think about it, if you're running $500 a month, or $500 a week, excuse me, you're running $2,000 a month, you're probably working part-time, full-time. So you're clearly not 100% disabled.
Yeah.
So it kind of makes sense. You can float back on. You can, if you the job doesn't work out, you can go back on. This gets us down the road into Medicare, Medicaid as well, which we talk a little bit about because those systems are equally almost as jacked up. But you know, at the end of the day, it's because what was designed as a solution for a small population, Medicaid, for instance, designed for folks in poverty that needed health insurance. Really, it was designed for single mothers with children, really, to make sure the children had health insurance, is now ballooned out of control and is now, you know, so large that I want to hear a conspiracy theory.
Yeah, sure.
So it costs about $13,000 a month for someone to be in a nursing home. So when someone's on Medicaid, because they don't have their own resources, so at their nursing home, Medicaid pays for them. So it costs about $180,000 a year for the state to pay for someone to be in the nursing home. So if you've got 10 people in a nursing home, it costs the state $1.8 million per nursing home. So the state of New York has a massive multi-billion-dollar budget for Medicaid. When I heard at COVID that they were taking people who were COVID positive, adults, not elderly and disabled, not in order to go in a nursing home, you have to not be able to exhibit daily care, acts of daily care. So you can't wash yourself, you can't feed yourself. You have to have like one or two in order to go to a nursing home. When I saw that New York was taking, folks that were, 30s, 40s, that were clearly okay, but they had COVID and they were putting them into nursing homes. My first reaction to that is, oh, they're trying to kill everyone in the nursing home because they're going to cut their Medicaid budget in half. That was my first reaction. And it's been floated and it's never been investigated. And I don't know that that's a fact, but it was just weird to me that you would take someone who is, 35, whose only thing is they've got COVID, and put them in a nursing home with your most vulnerable population. So again, was it a poorly thought out compassionate tactic, or was the state looking at it going, oh, hey, we could save, a couple $100 million if we just put folks with COVID positive into a nursing home and like half the folks there catch it. So it's weird some of the stuff that you see going on. But Medicaid, which was originally designed for kids and impoverished, has been expanded to include the homeless population as well, provide insurance and services and other things. So as a result, fascinatingly enough, there's a, because again, it was designed for kids in nursing homes and poverty line, there's a cap amount you're allowed to have in resources. Usually it's anywhere between $1,500 and $2,000. You can't have more than that in a bank. You can't have more than that in an asset. You can't have more than that anywhere. So if you get these folks that are homeless on the street and they're getting, maybe they worked. I had a guy that was getting $2,600 a month in Social Security because he had a fantastic job before his addiction took over, and he was living out of his car, so he had all his Social Security money available for drugs. If they, $2,600 and you have a $1,500 cap a month, I have to actively spend $2,000 a month of his money, or he accumulates it too fast and he loses his health insurance. He loses Medicaid. So you get these wild situations where you've got these very, very definitive lines where this condition has to be met, and it's not thought out why. It's an arbitrary number that's chosen. And you end up with people in trouble and losing insurance or losing housing or losing options or losing things just because, hey, in the month of January, they had, $1,501 in an account because you just couldn't spend it fast enough. Or they didn't cash a rent check, or someone, the electric company bill wasn't as much as you. So, you're dumping all the money in the card and telling them, take it off in cash, go buy yourself a wardrobe or something. And they just didn't hit the ATM that day. And now their insurance is gone. And there's a weird balance that has to be run. And as conservators we help, but a lot of these folks don't have conservatives. A lot of states in the United States don't have a conservator program, or if they do, it takes various different forms. It might be private, might be a law firm. Here in Maryland, it's one law firm that does all the conservator contracts for the entire state of Maryland. If you ever take a look at Maryland, understand that Maryland runs from Ohio, because that bar runs across the entire bottom of Pennsylvania. So as wide as Pennsylvania is, Maryland's wider, and then runs, down the shore and is bifurcated by the bay. So for me to get to, Assateague or to Ocean City from DC, I have to go all the way up to Baltimore and around all the way down. It's like a 2.5 hour drive that would be like a 35-minute drive if the bay wasn't there. So it's the most bizarre state, but it's one law firm runs the entire state. So great system, no, but that's how they developed it, because again, a lot of these systems were invented and developed in like, the 40s and the 50s, and they've just never been revisited. So again, how does this go to the homeless population? How does this go to our current crisis in homelessness? Because you have, again, I said it's a complex issue. You have systems that were invented in the 40s and 50s that have never been updated. You have advocacy groups that are compassionate and well-meaning, but creating systems that directly harm homeless population, like the wet dry shelter issue. You have organizations, political and other, that are creating these nonprofits as a way of generating, refunds or money to come back into PACs and campaigns. And then you have people that are burned out and they're just like, I am here to make money. And so you end up in these situations where it's chaos. And I'll give you an example. So contract I'm working on in St. Paul. You have it's Minnesota's got one of the best systems for housing homeless I have seen yet. And there may be another one in the United States, and there may be one in a foreign country that's better. I don't know how they have Minnesota is amazing. I don't say that just because I'm working there. I say that because I haven't worked there, I found out. They have what they call an adult foster care system. So just like foster care for kids, they have an adult foster care. They have individuals who have open houses with rooms, provide meals and support services. They refer, it's an AFC. They have a number of state licensed systems that are out there that like you could turn around and say, I'm going to buy that property. It's got three bedrooms. I'm going to set it up. I'm going to put support services in. I'm going to get a contract with the state. I'm going to house three individuals here who need help. And you can just run it as a business. And you will not make a lot of money doing it, quite frankly. You may lose some money doing it, but it allows you as a person that says, I see a need, I recognize a need, I can turn around and get licensed, or you don't even have to have a license. There are what are called sober homes. People will buy a house. Usually a lot of people who are former addicts or addicts who are you know, working through, and they recognize the need to, we have to have somewhere that is sober, that it allows no substances, no condition. Again, it's a rented property. It's private. A lot of them set them up under hotel rules. Hotel rule is you rent the bed, you don't rent the room. That way they don't have to do an eviction. That's how hotels can just boot you out because you're only renting the bed. You're not renting the room. So they set them up the same way. And then they offer them. And again, because they themselves are addicts and they understand the situation. So they're not, may not have a mental health background. They may not have a license, but they just want to be helpful in the community. So Minnesota has this incredible patchwork of systems, and then they've got contracted case management systems, they got support systems, but no one talks to each other. No one talks to each other. You'll have someone will open a home and it's like they'll call whatever they think the local case management system is, and that agency may have one intake number. You cannot call a case manager directly. You cannot talk to a supervisor. You call the number and say, hey, I've got a house, I got three rooms, I could take clients in. And they call in, and then that message gets lost. And they're calling in frequently, and they're like, hey, I exist. So what you find is there are case managers that have, like, they know two or three landlords. There are case managers that, you know, may go to the supervisor who's only been there 4 years. They, you know, may have four or five landlords in that immediate area. And if their beds are all full, there's not much they can do. So as part of the project that we were working on, we've been working with case management agencies and as many housing providers as we can find. And we do a monthly meeting and we said, hey, you tell us what would be a great system for communication. And I swear to you, one of the supervisors, I love her to death. She's funny. And she likes to pick on me. I think she was just picking on me. She said, you know what, we should be able to, all the landlords send you an email to all the bed openings. And then you send an email out to us that tells us where all the bed openings are. I think she was joking, but I took it seriously, and so did the project manager. And we sat down and talked, and I'm like, is there a way we can do this? He's like, you know, interestingly enough, in Microsoft, I do forms. And what we do is you get a form in Microsoft, you fill out the form, you see them, you get a link, you go to the link, you type in your name, if you're registering for an event or any of that kind of stuff. It's all forms. That's what it is. He's like, but I capture that information, the information form gets sent to me. And I have it. That's how I know who's attending, you know, what kind of lunch they want, you know, all this. Stuff. So I get the information in a database. He's like, I wonder, is there a way to take that information and put it into a PDF and email it out? I don't know. So the county has a license to Microsoft. So reached out to Microsoft. Hey, we can do this. I'm like, oh, yeah, no, absolutely. You can do that. So I'm like, so we're like, so we can send a form out, a link to every housing provider. And we found out there's like 4,000 of them in a 20-mile radius around St. Paul. Like, there's a ton of housing. Every housing manager in a 20-mile radius. Yeah. And they, if they've got a bed opening, they click this link to fill in information and send it back to us. I'm like, oh, yeah, yeah. And then we can take that and we can dump it into a PDF and send that out to every case manager in every county around us. You know, Hennepin is Minneapolis and Anoka and, you know, everyone. And they would get a list of every available bed right now. They're like, yeah, you could do that. So we're setting it up. We needed to get a license. Like, we're on the verge of doing that. It's an incredibly simple and elegant solution to communicating with everyone. And we are the first ones to do it, to recognize. First. Yeah, no one else does this. And in the country, no one else does it. And it's killing me because it's so simple. It's so simple. And by the way, in case, you know, for those that don't have like a Microsoft, Google is just the same thing. Google has their licensure. They've got the exact same mirrored system. You can do it with Google. And I know this because actually then talking to people about it, universities and other folks have similar systems set up. Just no one ever thought, hey, this is a way to do it. So that's the interesting thing is it's low hanging fruit. Some of these system solutions, because you would think coming from the private sector, oh, this already exists. You don't understand that because of the patchwork chaos that's been created by, hey, we invented a system in the 40s or 50s. And as you know, in the 70s, when everyone got dumped out onto the street, when the hospitals closed, and we're told, hey, there's community services, but there were no community services. The communities reeled and then tried to create these services. There's even in some place like, you know, a large system like San Francisco or Los Angeles, there's no coherency to it. So when they say, hey, we dumped $29 billion into this system, what they did is they made $29 billion available. The nonprofits went, hey, we can expand, we can do this, we can do that. And you know, CEOs all got raises, you know, they created other jobs, they created other systems, but they don't necessarily communicate with one another. They definitely don't coordinate services necessarily. There's no way of knowing. So, you know, something like this, we could turn on and take, and we're going to roll out and essentially just say, hey, anyone can do this anywhere. This is how you do it. This is the template to follow. And that's our plan. Once we get it in, there's actually a stage two. We're going to apply for another grant in the next 2 years. We're actually going to move it to an even more comprehensive and better system, but we're still talking about that. But just something as simple as this is available and possible.
Hey, sorry to interrupt, but are you looking to reach a dynamic and engaged audience of curious minds? Well, look no further. Bright Brains Podcast is the perfect platform to showcase your business or product. You'll be able to reach a diverse and intelligent audience and engage with listeners passionate about personal development, technology, and more. Elevate your brand through thought-provoking discussions. Don't miss this opportunity to promote your business on one of the fastest-growing podcasts in the market. Contact us today to discuss advertising options and elevate your brand to the next level. Contact us at brightbrainspod@gmail.com to secure your advertising spot on Bright Brains today. Again, that's Bright Brains with a Z, pod, P-O-D, at gmail.com. Now, back to the podcast.
Let me ask you this. So a lot of these people, though, ones you said have dual diagnosis, you know, mentally ill and addicted to drugs. Is this like the best that we can hope for is to just, you know, get them permanently in some kind of home? Do you have any kind of success stories of people like beating their addictions and, you know, getting mentally healthy and then, you know, becoming a productive member of society? Is that the goal, or is the goal just to get these people off the street and that's the best we can hope for?
So here's the issue. And this is where you kind of get into the mental health arena is conflicted and don't quite know what to do. So let's start with the difference between axis A and axis B, mental health diagnosis. So someone who is schizoaffective, bipolar, has a true, you know, mental health issue that can be medicated and treated. So someone who is schizoaffective, there are medications out there that will lessen or eliminate or alleviate the auditory and visual hallucinations that are seen. That's a mental health issue that can be corrected with medication. There are doctors, attorneys, engineers, ditch diggers. There are people who lead productive lives. They're absolutely in careers, married, kids, the whole nine yards, who are have a mental health diagnosis, have found a medication regime that works, and they're good to go. Bam, done. The other side is axis B, which is personality disorders, the dark triad, or, you know, there's a ton of information out there. You cannot treat a personality disorder. It's untreatable. So narcissism, sociopathy, you know, any of those, the person, the borderline, which I don't think the borderline personality disorder exists anymore. I think they got rid of that, the diagnosis, but personality disorders can't be treated. The individual has to come forward and say, I want to work with this. So I want to make that clear to answer your question. When it comes to folks that are schizoaffective and addicted, that in no way, shape, or form means they cannot contribute positively to society if they are properly medicated and dealing with their addiction. 100%. 100% can be, without question, a positive impact on society. Quite frankly, someone with an AXS-B personality disorder, I mean, that's welcome to Twitter or X. When you start reading through there, it's like the amount of personality disorders that's literally what you're looking at for the most part is AXS-B personality disorder.
Yeah.
Anyways, so the phrase is the first part. The question is, how do we deal with what's going on? So a lot of the folks that I have that are not being productive, that are repeatedly on the street in jail and else, have massive, massive trauma histories. So I'll give you an example. So this is a fictional example based on some reality. You have an individual who was sexually and physically abused as a child, who then develops schizoaffective disorder. I mean, you're talking like this. Not only does it exist, it's a lot more common than you realize. And I mean, you know, you're in over your head and trying to swim upstream against a rough current when you've got addiction, mental health, and trauma history. But I mean, if you start looking at like prisons, if you start looking at prisons particularly, I think it's 80% of incarcerated individuals have some form of trauma history. Like the childhood trauma particularly is going to set you up for failure if it's not addressed at some level. So the folks that are really, really down and out, when you start talking to them, when you get to know them, you find out that they've got massive trauma history. And that's it. That's the difference to me. That when I look at someone who's schizoaffective and they're a surgeon, and yes, there are folks on medication who are diagnosed schizoaffective, and they're yes. And some yeah. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Trust me, I personally know one who's an attorney and medical doctor. So I don't personally know a surgeon who's schizoaffective. I'm just saying that it wouldn't shock me even slightly to find out that there is. So, you know, again, very productive member of society, and someone who is, you know, on a corner, you know, with one shoe and, you know, a sign saying, you know, please, you know, donate for my pot or whatever. I've seen a couple of those that make me laugh, at least being honest, is trauma history and unresolved trauma history. So, it has not been uncommon for me to have clients who are what I call unhousable. Because their trauma history is rooted in childhood, as I pointed out, particularly with sexual abuse, but sexual and physical trauma dealing with childhood because they can't be alone at night. So if you try to put them in an apartment where they're by themselves, they won't make it. Because the minute the lights go out, the minute they're laying there by themselves, I don't care how much medication they're on, I don't care what's happening, the minute the lights are out and the minute they're laying in a bed, that trauma history is coming back. And it is more likely than not, and this is why you get a lot of folks to go to the hospital. Why do you go to the hospital? Because there are bright lights and it's safe. I know if I'm in the hospital, it's safe. Someone's going to be around, walking around and protect me. A lot of them go to jail. Why do they go to jail? Because it's safe. And I know that sounds funny because anyone that's ever been inside is like looking what the hell are you talking about? It's safer than themselves because there are guards there. There's someone in the cell with them. If they get along with that person, or at least not in conflict with that person, you know, someone else is there and, you know, it's barred and no one can get in to get them. The boogeyman from their history, from their trauma history, can't get to them. So that's it. That's your dividing line. So how do you deal with trauma? And then how do you help someone through that trauma, profound trauma? And how do you help someone through that profound, how do you get someone to want to work through that profound trauma? Because that's the other side. A lot of them, they may admit it, they may not admit it. It might be in a record. You might get hints or intimations about it. But a lot of men do not want to talk about being sexually abused. It is not culturally appropriate. It is a very vulnerable thing to do. So, you know, you've got to cross that bridge before you can even begin to deal with trauma history.
Does it seem like the people who have childhood trauma is increasing, or has it just always been this way and we're just seeing it because, like you said, they shut down the hospitals in the 70s?
That's an interesting question. I don't know because I don't work in that area. I'm professionally touched by it because my clients suffer it. I try to get, you know, trauma care for my clients. I've never looked at statistics to see. This is one of the things that advocates, I was a huge one for it when COVID hit and we shut down, was the amount of childhood trauma that's going to occur because now, you know, kids get seen in school, kids get seen in outside, and that's when you usually find out kids are being abused, neglected. Because we closed the schools down, suddenly, you know, perpetrators had full access to kids and there was no way for that child to seek help. So I suspect we're going to see a lot of trauma occurring coming out of 2020 to 22.
I
When those
agree.
kids are older, we're gonna see a lot more. We're also seeing so I was in elementary school for 10 years, elementary school teacher. My master's is in early childhood development. And again, I did CPS. One of the things that again, I've talked about, and one of the things that I have seen, and we're a bit off from homelessness, but it does all kind of fall into the same bucket, is 90% of kids will behave in a very normative range. You know, if you're talking to a 13-year-old girl, she is not going to, your average normative range, she's not going to talk about sex. It's too uncomfortable. Like, so when you have a 13-year-old girl that wants to talk about sex, that's outside the normative range. And it raises questions. You know, why is this person comfortable talking about this particular topic that 90% of kids won't talk about? Fighting is, particularly in school, is not a normative thing. So when kids are willing to fight or something is going on, they're willing to do blows and physical altercation. You have to ask why. You know, what is going on, not at the school, but what is going on in this child's home life? What is going on outside the school? Because most kids, normative range, want to get along. Like, most kids are compassionate and friendly. Actually, most kids are incredibly compassionate. That's a whole other talk. But so when you have kids that get into conflict that are then, you know, willing to lash out, you have to say, okay, what's happening outside of the school in this person's home life and this life that's leading to this? So watching part of it also is, are schools violent? Yes. When I was an elementary school teacher, my first year I was in Bridgeport, which is one of the poorest cities in the United States, next to one of the wealthiest cities in the United States. Connecticut's a fascinating state. So it was 92. We pulled four handguns out of what essentially was an elementary school. Kids that were going to had plans to shoot, have a shootout. So kids reported, we were able to get it taken care of. No gunfire ever happened. But, you know, back in 92, we were pulling handguns out because kids were going to shoot the place up. So the violence has always been there. What has changed, I think, though, is phones and being able to record it. So I think people who are outside of the education system and outside of working with kids who have known about this, you know, for 40 years, the general public is now getting to see what we've known about for 40 years. So it may appear that there is an escalation of issues because suddenly these videos are all hitting the internet or they're on X or they're on, you know, wherever, when in fact these issues have always been there and have always occurred. So what may be a perceived escalation may just be, you know, kind of, again, it's this pretty standard stuff. But I don't know. I think that we're gonna, again, as mentioned, we're gonna see some massive trauma stuff coming out of COVID and the lockdowns. Kids got isolated with perpetrators. We're seeing some other things coming up that I think are interesting. I don't know. I haven't seen data to say there's been an expansion. You know, 20 years ago, you were more or less likely to be molested or physically abused than, you know, these days. I haven't seen it. But it doesn't mean it's not there. I don't know. It's not my wheelhouse.
So let me ask you this. Let's say somebody high up, like governor, senator, or somebody, they come to you and they said, we want to make a change on how we do this homelessness thing and how we, house people and treat people. And whatever it is you say needs to be done, we'll do it. What needs to be done? What changes?
Okay, this is where I'm gonna lose some fans.
All right.
But no, I mean, I genuinely. So here's let me preface this with why I think the way that I do, and then I'll tell you, give you the answer. So I'll have a client who's in a group home and is meeting with success. They are getting their chores done. They're making their bed. They may have a little job on the side. They're appropriately spending their money. They are doing well. They are meeting with success. The current system will say, oh, we need to move you to a less restrictive care. You're meeting with your all your goals. And you're doing really well in this environment. So what we're going to do is rip you out of this environment, and we're going to put you in an environment with less supports. And we're going to see what happens. So you're doing well in a group home. We're going to give you your own apartment. And I hate that with a passion, because if someone's meeting success and is happy and is doing well in an environment, then maintain that environment because they're happy and they're successful. But that's not how we're set up at this point. So there's a lot of people like, oh, this is great, because you know, that goal is they really do envision for this person. We're going to get them to a point where, you know, they've got a job and they've got a career and they're living in an apartment, they're driving a car, and like, that's their vision for this person. And I'm coming back with, they have a functional IQ of 74. They are doing well because they have this support services. If you remove the supports, they're going to fail. And because I'm not a social worker, so I don't approach it that way. I approach it in a very practical way. So I have seen too many times, because this is the problem. And I actually had this happen where the kid was in the group home. They wanted to move through a less restrictive environment. I said, I will only agree to it if you keep the bed open at the group home. Like, what do you mean? Like, because if you move him out and he moves into an environment where he fails, I need to move him back into the environment where he succeeded. So if you want to move him from here, group home, support services, to apartment, mental support services, and he fails, I need to be able to get him back in. Now, group homes are very uncommon, and waiting lists are 2 to 3 years. So if you move him here and he fails, it could be 2 years. Now, his failure is going to mean he's going to end up hospitalized for a period of time. His failure could mean he ends up homeless. His failure could mean he ends up as an addict. Like, these are the risks that you are exposing him to, because this is his history, and we're going to regress. So I will only agree to move him if you maintain the bed availability. And we can come up with reasonable time, 6 months. You have to maintain the bed for 6 months. If after 6 months he's successful in the apartment, that's great. But I have to have a safety net for him, and they refused. So we ended up fighting a lot about it. And what they ended up doing, interestingly enough, is moving him. They actually moved him to a different group home. So I think internally what was going on is they didn't like it. And then they don't like them. So they just wanted him out. Is kind of, but again, I run into it a lot where you have folks that they're in a nursing home and they're meeting their daily care needs. And there's this question of, well, do they really need to be in the nursing home? They're successful here with these supports. Maybe they could be in the community. It's like, okay, we have a number of states, this thing called, there are different names, but essentially it's money follows the person. So the money that you would get for the nursing home, they go get an apartment and get you 24/7 care. Believe it or not, it's half the cost. So if a nursing home is $14,000, having you in the community with 24/7 care is $7,000. So there's a financial incentive for the state to move you on Medicaid from one location to the other. But what happens is they end up isolated, because whereas in the nursing home, they're around folks coming in and out, they're around other residents, they have relationships, they may have friendships, family may be coming in to visit them. They move into an apartment where they're not mobile, they don't have a car, they can't drive, they can't necessarily get out. And the person that is there, rotational shifts, you're gonna be there 7 hours a day. So they'll get four people a day, and then they get, you know, so they'll have a staff of like seven or eight people that are coming in and out, and it's a job. So they don't transport, they don't drive, they don't, may not have cars. A lot of the time they don't have cars. So you end up isolating that individual in that apartment, they deteriorate, and they end up going back into the nursing home, where they were happier anyways, because they had relationships and they had people they talked to, and they made puzzles and they played cards and they had, you know, bands come in and play for them, and they had relationships with nurses on staff, and you know, they were thriving in this environment. So they rip them from the environment and they put them in a different environment, and they can't figure out why they're not thriving. So all of that said, I think what we need to do is determine levels of care and establish places for levels of care. And that means bringing back hospitals. I think there are people that thrive in an environment, and they do thrive, that is an institutionalized environment where their meals are ready, their medications are prepared, And I don't mean like, you know, the excesses of the things that led to closing the hospital in the 70s. But, you know, so they have access to grounds. They can walk the grounds. They can go outside and garden. They can do all these things. But there are people that do not do well in open environments or unsupported. And there is a population of people that are on the street that are homeless, starving, dying of dehydration, and using drugs to ease the pain because they can't, they, you know, they're in constant pain because of medical or mental health issues, and they can't get their medications, or they don't want to, you know, be beholden to the system. And they're, so they're actively dying, that in a hospital environment could be thriving. So the first thing I would argue, all of that said, is we need to bring back hospitals, and not for immediate trauma care, risk of self to risk of self, risk to other. I mean, actually bring back institutionalized structured care. We need to bring it back.
I think, you know, it was like you said, it was 70s. What I was always told was it was Ronald Reagan, and that the reason why he was against these hospitals is because his mother was abused in one of these hospitals. Is there any truth to that? Have you ever heard of that before? Or is that just like...
No, it goes back to Geraldo Rivera. The reason why, and I'm a very huge Geraldo Rivera fan, so I'm not picking on him when I say this. But Geraldo went to a hospital in Long Island, and it was hell. It was, if you ever go, you can find the videos from him actually in the hospital interviewing folks and looking at it. It was unexcusable. And a lot of hospitals are like that. Patients being abused, patients being sexually abused, people literally in filth. Kids were in the hospitals in like cages. It was unacceptable anywhere in the world, but when you look at it in the United States. So he did an expose on hospitals in the 70s, then that's what actually led to a lot of them shutting down and his move to community services. I do believe, yes, that Reagan and a number of other people, because what was happening was, because he comes out of an era where like women were being hospitalized for hysteria, which is where that comes from. And hysterectomy has the exact same origin. There's a whole reason for that word, where it comes from. And women were just being housed because they were perceived to be unstable. You know, they had their own opinions. You know, suffragettes were probably, you know, they would have hospitalized all of them because, you know, how could women have this opinion? The fascinating history and the abuses committed on women in hospitalized sessions, places and some of the stuff done, is horrific. So I believe, yes, his mother was. I believe that is the case. I believe that he was not a fan of the system. But again, I recommend it. I say we need to go to it, but again, not. It's a very clear distinction between the system that was and the system as I think we could do, which is we have monitoring in place. We have inspectors in place. We have an understanding and expectation of what they should be. And I think if they were thoughtfully designed, again, not bars on the doors and cages on the windows, but, you know, the safety precautions in place, but access to grounds, access to sunlight, access to be able to be out. A huge fan of gardening, meditative as well as, you know, that act of growing something, I think is very important to people as a human being. And the creation of, you know, life, you're bringing something into being, you're growing something. I think it's very, very important. So the ability to garden, the ability to grow things, the ability to get on the grounds, the ability to be, you know, to go for walks and be in sun is incredibly important. So I think we could design systems that are almost very similar to nursing homes in a way. I think hospitals got that kind of bad reputation that we could do.
Yeah. So the pushback to this, is it just people don't want their tax money being raised to go to these hospitals? Or are there... is it just people have bad memories of the 70s?
Yeah. Well, yeah. The mental health profession, because they are again, remember we're in that client-centered approach, which is you're on the street and you're dying. I'm going to give you the needles you need. So at least the needles are clean to use your drugs. Like, I'm going to support your decisions because someone who is, as I pointed out at the beginning, someone who is in a state of psychosis is treated by, you know, current mental health system as if they're perfectly rational as you are right now. So that's the issue. And I think, so there's going to be pushback from the mental health industry in that if you put someone somewhere, they are no longer determinative of their own fate. They no longer have free will. You have, in fact, blocked them away and deprived them of rights. But that is the Zeno's, you know, half distance argument. It sounds right, but it's not actually accurate, because if that individual were in a rational state of mind and you were to say, hey, would you rather be on the street, starving to death, dehydrated, and using, you know, fentanyl to take care of the pain? Or would you rather be in a clean environment where someone is doing your laundry and preparing meals for you, where you are guaranteed to be safe, but you have the ability to, you know, access grounds or go places? What do you think they're going to say?
They're going to stay at home.
Of course they are. Now,
yeah.
I'm not, again, that's also theoretical, not just the reality, because I mean, dealt with addiction in clients for a very long time. I'm the person that I have an enormous amount of respect for addicts who work in addiction services, who work with addicts, who open sober homes or anything else, because they walk that walk, they live that life, they really thoroughly understand it. I am not an addict. I've never dealt with addiction. So personally, it's a hypothetical theoretical to me. I have dealt with addicts, you know, professionally for a very, very long time. So I kind of have an idea what's going on with it. But I myself, having never suffered from addiction, the first one to say that I don't understand it. So I don't judge addicts. And I'm very clear about that, particularly with my clients. I had an artist, he's passed away. I love this guy to death. Incredible artist, profoundly schizophrenic. But I mean, fascinating guy. His art was insanely good. He didn't like being sober. So he used heroin, and he had a 4-pack-a-day heroin habit. And he was perfectly open about it. He used heroin. So he was using enough to sustain. So he didn't go through withdrawal or anything else. He wasn't getting high, because he'd been using for so long, 4 packs of heroin wasn't going to do anything for him. But he was just, that was his way of sustaining. So he did a 4-bag-a-day heroin habit. And it was his conservator. I'm like, I'm not giving you money. I'm giving you money, you know, every week to go buy food. What you do with the money, I can't control. But I'm going to be very clear. I'm not giving you money to buy heroin. But no, so he's selling his art. He would do art, and he'd sell art. And that's what he used to buy his heroin. He and I talked about it. We had conversations about it. Because again, I'm not being judgmental with him about it. That's what he did. That was his life. He was an addict, and that was how he's maintaining. So anything I say when it comes to addiction, I want to make sure very clear. I don't judge, and I have no judgment when it comes to it, particularly because I've never lived that life, and I don't suffer from it. But I also understand that, you know, I had a client making $2,600 a month at Social Security, had a fantastic job. His great Social Security, was living in his car so he could use all $2,600 for drugs.
Wow.
And if you asked him, do you want house? He said, nope. I wanted drugs. I like doing drugs. I want to do drugs. So that addiction is really something that you have to agree to address and come to terms with and deal with. And as it turns out, shockingly, that client had a massive trauma history. So a lot of times when I, you know, when you start talking with folks about it and what's going on, I'm not a therapist. I'm not a social worker. I don't ask, because it's not my role. It's not my job, but I'm a human being and they're a human being and we have conversations. So we'll talk about, you know, family and childhood and other stuff. And a lot of times I'll end up sharing, hey, this is what happened to me as a kid, or this is where I was, and anything else. And to a T, just insane amounts of trauma. And it always seems proportional. Like the worse choices people are making, the more trauma that they've got in their background.
And the thing is, it's like, how do you heal that trauma? I don't think anybody really knows. You know, that's the crazy thing.
There is trauma-based therapy. There is a way to do it. There's I think some very effective strategies actually in mental health for dealing with trauma. But you yourself have to be willing to go to walk back through that trauma and heal from it and deal with it. So
yeah. All right, then. So I just have one last question.
Sure.
And then we can wrap it up. So just the average person, what can they do to help homeless people?
Stop giving money to homeless. Please God, stop. Don't do it. Don't stop. Please stop. Please do not. Now, I have given meals to folks on the street. I've given food. I've walked by and I'm like, what do you need? They're like, I want something to eat. I will go buy food. I have given directions to shelters. I've helped them that way. That can be very dangerous. I have a cousin who of all things was in Chicago or Cincinnati, it's a sea city, and was like going into a 7-Eleven. There was a guy outside, and he said, "What do you need?" He said, "Can I get a hot dog?" And he's like, "You want it and a drink?" He's like, "Yeah, can I get a hot dog and a soda?" It's like, "I'll buy a hot dog." So went inside and got a couple of hot dogs and a soda for the guy. Stepped outside to give it to the guy. His buddy hit him in the jaw so hard it shattered his jaw.
Damn.
Just didn't like the fact that he was buying food for the guy. And he literally ended up hospitalized, had his jaw rewired, had to, you know, learn to re-eat and speak, just because he was buying food for this one guy, and the other guy just wasn't a fan of it. So, you know, environmental awareness, be careful what you do. You know, all the good intentions in the world are not going to help when someone's in a psychotic state. That's why I don't wear ties anymore, actually. So very specifically, I've had clients grab me by the tie. I was in a hospital visiting someone, and he's floridly psychotic and grabbed me by the tie. The nurse next to me was like, just look at me like, you're going to die. Like, there's nothing I can do. You're going to die. I got him to let go. Still my client to this day, actually, like 10 years. Yeah, good guy. He makes bad decisions, but I think he was just trying to be friendly. I think he just was like, oh, this is cute, grabbed by the tie. So I reached out, grabbed him by the shoulder, say, you okay? And, you know, we chatted a little bit. He let go of the tie. I never wore a tie since. I will not wear ties. So my recommendation as the average person is, if you can identify a food bank, someone that deals directly with the homeless population, food banks especially, food kitchens that prepare meals, volunteer. Like, and I don't mean like every day, and I don't mean even once a week, once a month. They need people just to help out with meal preparation or anything else. Meals on Wheels. Give all your money to Meals on Wheels. I'm kind of joking, but that is, it's kind of funny because people are like, oh, Meals on Wheels, you know, how good going to be? I am telling you right now, they have professional chefs at Meals on Wheels. We actually had them cater an event. That food, it's so good. They need money. So if you really want to make an impact and you really want to help, find a service that directly deals with poor, impoverished, and homeless population. And volunteer, if you don't have money, volunteer your time. One day a month. If everyone did one day a month, we would do an amazing impact. Donate if you can. Donate to soup kitchens, food kitchens, and a meal, anything else. But I mean, really importantly, is try to remember that these really are human beings who have been through an amazing amount of trauma, and this is kind of where they're at, because that trauma, their mental health issues. Again, they are underwater, trying to swim upstream against the current. Like, everything that they try to do is a massive effort. So just treat them with respect. You know, don't look down on them, because trust me, if you've been through what they've been through or suffering what they're suffering from, chances are good you'd be in the same place. It's
For sure.
overwhelming.
All right then. Hey, this has been a great conversation. I
Yeah.
learned a lot.
Good. Glad.
I feel like we could be here for two
All
more
day.
hours, honestly. Yeah. So do you have anything to promote? Do
No.
you have like nothing at all? All
Nope.
right then.
Nope. Nope.
What if people want to like reach out to you, like if they have questions or anything like that? Do you have anything you want to put out
If you
there,
want to throw
or
up my email address I sent you, which is friarlegalllc@gmail.com.
all right then.
That email is wide open. Please feel free to drop me an email if you've got a question, if you've got a thought, if you anything else. If you're comfortable, send me a phone number. I'm more than happy to call anyone anytime and have a chat. So,
Awesome. All right then. Hey, this has been a, like I said, great conversation. I really appreciate you coming here. Thank you, and take care.
Isaac, thank you for having me. And I got to say, this is I don't, you have a background in journalism or interviewing, or is this just something you kind of came
No,
to? Because this has been
just
fantastic. This has been fantastic interview. You did like I'm overly beyond impressed.
yeah, so I just feel like the mainstream media does not really tackle these kind of issues, you know. And I feel like there are people out there like you and who are dealing with these kind of issues, and we need to like get them, you know, talk to them and just figure out what's going on, because if you pay attention to CNN or Fox or anything like that, you're not getting the full story. So,
Right, no, you get bits and pieces, and it's all spin. You don't get, yeah, 100%.
yeah, so that's why I just started this podcast. And, you know, like if you see some of my episodes, some of them are serious, some of them are kind of goofy, but, you know, You know, I feel like I needed to know for myself, you know, because so I just said, let me start this podcast and let me just start reaching out to people and start figuring out what's going on. And
when you get this wrapped up, let me know. Send me a link.
All right, then
we'll promote it Appreciate out there for you. Okay.
Awesome. Thank you.
No, thank you, Isaac. This has been great. Seriously, you're awesome. Thank you very much.
Hey, no problem, man. Take care.
You too.
All right. That's a wrap. Thank you for joining us for another enlightening conversation here on Bright Brains. I hope you've gained valuable insights and inspiration to fuel your own bright ideas. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe, rate, and leave a review on your favorite podcast platform or however else you listen to this podcast. Also, we can be found on all major social media. Just type in Bright Brains with a Z. And remember, the brightest minds are those that never stop seeking knowledge.